artists and writers and creators, because as we were talking yesterday when you came to fetch me at the airport, the Tibetan artistic, which include, you know, performance, writing, all kind of arts, is very vibrant in Tibet, but hardly anyone knows about it. And it's vibrant and risky for Tibetan artists if they really pursue their own goal. So I think it's quite unfair that we shouldn't know about it, because there are big things, the stakes are high, risks are high, and I think it's quite despairing for them to know that they are not listened to outside, although their main aim is not to be listened to outside. They speak for Tibetans. But if we know about them, I think also it can give them confidence and a kind of a legitimacy to what they say. So this comes from, I must confess, you know, because it's a late invitation. I didn't have time to prepare something. I mean, I know it's not a conference. It's not I don't have to talk and you listen. I know it's an exchange, but I felt we needed some, you know, kind of a basic frame, you know, from which to discuss. And I have given a few times a talk about what's the position of the artist in today's Tibet, you know. What challenges do you face? How do you escape the traps? And how do you make your message come across? So this comes from my listener. So I think maybe we should start maybe with a geographic reminder. Where is Tibet? I shouldn't have shown you the map. I should have asked you, where do you think Tibet is? I know you are all highly educated, but even among highly educated people, there's a misunderstanding about what is Tibet and where is Tibet. First, you can look at the map in the bottom right bottom corner. This is today's China map, you know, relief map, the right here. The white part is all Tibet. So Tibet is 1/4 of China. To begin with, I think very few people realize that. You know, they think it's like it's a province, or it's, you know, it's a region. It's about, you know, 1/10 maybe of the territory. No, it's huge, and so it occupies the southwest of China. Actually, you know, if you look at this at a map, this is altitude elevation map. It really matches the linguistic map. You know, there's no trick here. You know, the white part is the place where Tibetan lives, and up to until 1950, only Tibetans. A few Muslims, a few other people, but it was quite homogeneous culturally, linguistically, ethnically. And contrary to what most Tibetan activists say, the Tibetan population is not swamped out by Chinese population. Only in town. Towns are problematic. You have a huge influx of Chinese or Muslim, but we make a difference here, but it's all non-Tibetan anyway. Population coming from the eastern part of China. That's the case for Lhasa, the main city. We don't know how many people live in Lhasa. It's kind of a secret. The Chinese government won't let us know the statistics. Or when they give you statistics, everybody's very suspicious, you know, because it looks a bit weird that there are very few Chinese when you walk in Lhasa and you see it's a Chinese town anyway. But in the countryside, and most Tibetans are still farmers and herders, 85% of the population consists of farmers and herders. Nobody can live, you know, nobody but Tibetans can live in such a harsh environment anyway. So there is no allogenic or allogen population coming from outside who can settle down as farmers or herders. So it's still very homogeneous. But in the, of course, there's a borderline here, you know, where it turns from white to red. And in these are lower places. And in these parts, you have a mix of Tibetans and Chinese now. Sometimes only 25% Tibetan, sometimes 5%, 50% of the population. Okay, so Tibet is divided traditionally between, so this is, this is it again, three provinces. The Tibetan call them three provinces: Amdo, which I just mentioned, Cam, and this is called Utsang. And I can never find a map which has everything on it. So Utsang is missing. It's the name of the third province. This was the traditional division, and we will see that the artist, creative, vibrant life takes place in Amdo. Hmm. That's very interesting. Hmm. This is why I teach Amdo dialect, because I had to learn it, because I needed to talk to writers and poets, and they couldn't understand me. I was trying to speak the Lhasa dialect with enough difficulty, and anyway, it was useless, so I had to learn their dialect. We can discuss about why the Amdo people are so active. Actually, the man with whom I came, the filmmaker, Dorje, he's from there. All filmmakers are from there. 99% of the poets and the writers are from there. They're quite interesting reasons. So I've made a little charge, I hope. It's understandable. Five or four main attitudes of artists towards the state or towards authorities. So keep in mind it might be four and not five, sorry. So the reception among the Tibetan public would be like, Tibetan public like it, don't like it, Tibetan public will like it. And adhesion or support, so I should have said support, of the Chinese national project, like we're a unitary, multicultural, multinational country, we work in unity, and we all belong to China. So this is minus, and this is where people in their attitude stick to the Chinese national project or grand narrative, you can call it. So you have first a small group of artists who pay homage or who show allegiance, how do you say that?
Allegiance
to the state, and you can see that they are not very well accepted by the Tibetan public. I will illustrate each of them. Then you have passive support. Passive support is less enthusiastic for the Chinese grand narrative, but better accepted by the Tibetan public. Then you have a bigger group. I try to represent, well, of course, it's not very scientific. I don't have statistics or numbers, but from what I see, you have a huge number of Tibetan artists who stand, I call it the middle way as a reference to the Dalai Lama's position on, you know, everybody knows about that? No complete independence, no complete incorporation, you know, Tibet needs a full, he says, genuine autonomy within China. So it's a Buddhist term, middle way. It's a Mahayana Buddhist term, no extreme. And it's in direct contestation. Mm-hmm. Contestation, do you say that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's only four. And then you have resistance. Tibetans love it, but we will see it's not without risk. So allegiance, what are the characteristics? Total fidelity to the Chinese Communist Party, should be CCP. So they celebrate through songs and books and also paintings and films, celebration of Sino-Tibetan harmony, the development of Tibet, economic development of Tibet. They are usually state-sponsored. Hardly any independent, financially independent artists, Tibetan artists, would go into that category. They are heavily state-sponsored. Interestingly, they belong to the older generation. There are very few new singers, writers who cater into that category. They are ignored by the Tibetan audience, like this woman, Tseten Droma, 60 years of careers. Some people say she was Mao Zedong's mistress, but I don't know. it's too late. But I had never heard of her. I've been like 17 times to China, to Tibet, and talked to people about, you know, songs and everything. But no one ever mentioned her to me. I had to go through Chinese websites about Tibet to discover there was such a woman. And she's maybe the most famous Tibetan singer for Chinese people, because she's always on central television. Mm-hmm. And she's considered by the Chinese here means both government and the Chinese masses, icons of Tibetan art, in that case, mm-hmm. Tibetan singing, Tibetan drama. Her songs are ultra-political, pro-China. There you have a few political novels, like this one, The Defiant One by Yishi Tenzin. He's a Tibetan. As you can see, it's in English, so it was published, translated into English within China and published by the Chinese government at the I can't remember the whatever Beijing something press. So it's officially published, translated, supported. You can find it in bookstores in New York, etc., etc., in Beijing, of course. Yeshe Tenzin was a Red Guard, a very aggressive Tibetan Red Guard during the Cultural Revolution, and he still has a very ultra-leftist position. Mm. He belongs to the Tibetan Academy of Social Sciences, so he's quite a famous person. Mm. But same, you know, hardly anyone mentioned him to me as a writer, or a good writer. So passive support, you see that on TV shows, festivals, so I found this picture, you know, Tibet.China, so this is an official website. So you have a Tibetan horse race, you know, Tibetans love horse racing, and he's carrying the Chinese flag. Or you have grand shows, you know, kind of tacky, I think you can find this in Italy or whatever, you know, these Saturday evening big shows with tacky singers and usually this, but here it's political. They celebrate also the grand unity of China with its variety of population, and I think Tibetans find it entertaining enough. Non-Tibetans love it. You know, they usually they have shows in Beijing and Shanghai and big cities. And what I've noticed since 2008, because there was a huge crisis in Tibet in 2008, is that. From the pictures that I see on the internet, now when you look at these grand, big meetings of people, they don't smile. It seems to me there's a little of little resistance here. They're like singing, you know, dancing. Okay, they're here, they're paid, they belong to official state-sponsored dance companies. Sometimes they wear black. If they have a chance, you know, to choose their garments. So there, I'm beginning to see a little bit of resistance here, but it needs to be confirmed. Then more interesting is the middle way approach to me, of course, and I think for all of us. I said it was thriving, and I think this will prove you how thriving it is. That's just a few instances of what Tibetan creators, artists, are really developing now, have been developing for the last maybe 10 years. There's an independent poetry festival now in Tibet, not state-sponsored. I know it doesn't sound, so what, you know, you have many of them maybe here, but it's quite amazing for Tibetans to be able to meet and talk about poetry without the state interfering. Who's the organizer? Dorje Tsering, the filmmaker, who was here yesterday. No, he's a pillar of Tibetan creativity. He didn't come this morning because he still holds a Chinese passport. As I was telling you, he got a phone call on Wednesday morning, just before we were leaving. We left from Paris. He got a phone call from China, from his hometown, the police, who had traced him. Well, they always trace him. Said, "You're going somewhere, huh? Be careful, huh?" No, it's quite incredible, you know. And he's used to it, it's okay. He said, "Yes, I'm going somewhere. Yes, I'll be careful, thank you." he's a filmmaker, he's a poet, and he organized the first ever, and the only so far, independent Tibetan poetry festival. There are clubs of writers and poets. So this is a group of poets, so you need to have long hair and smoke a lot, and then you're a poet. It's a bit like that. There are about 20, that's the most famous one. They call the third generation poets because, you know, in China, I don't know if you're familiar with the Chinese scene, but in cinema, you talk in generations. So Zhang Yimou would be fifth generation, and now it's sixth generation.
This is measured since the revolution? Or since the...
I think it's since 49.
Okay, but in Tibetans, how do they measure their generations?
Okay, so they just make it up.
Okay.
So they said, we're third generation. First generation was the one who invented free verse poetry in 1983. Okay. He's an icon. He committed suicide 2 years later, at the age of 32, but he's a hero, cultural hero. Second generation was the poet and filmmaker I was with yesterday, Dorje. And Dorje is now about 50 years old, or 48 years old, and they're all in their 30s. And their approach to poetry and world poetry is a bit different. So they call themselves the third generation, in contrast with the the inventor of reverse and the generation that followed. We can talk about their characteristics later. There was a festival of Tibetan rock music in Hassa in 2009, privately sponsored. Independent films, strangely enough, there are non-state-sponsored Tibetan films. Hundreds of MTV, so Tibetans, apart from having developed a very sophisticated form of Buddhism, which we call, you know, Vajrayana or Tibetan Buddhism, extremely rich, extremely highbrow philosophically and practically. They also love singing and dancing. And this shows now with MTV, so you have some Tibetans now who make money making video clips for their friends, or no, not for their friends. They get some songs and someone say, can you make a video clip for me? And they make a video clip. And Tibetans love watching that. Hundreds of blogs in Tibetan language, so that's one. Pyisinchi, and you have Tibetan here, this is a picture. Thousands of poems published in state and private sponsored literary magazines. I counted about 150 literary magazines. And Tibetans are 6 million, only half of whom can read and write. So you have 3 million potential readers, and I don't think everybody who can read and write reads literature or poetry, right? So out of an ideal number of 3 million, you may have 1 million people who read poetry and literature, and they have a choice between 150 magazines, which is tremendous. Mm-hmm. I made a comparison for Canada. It would be like 2,000 literary magazines in Canada if it was were applied, you know, a population. I don't think you have 2,000 literary magazines in Canada. And internet is also a big thing, you know, Unicode, Tibetan, you can write it in Unicode now, so you can send emails. Now the iPhone has Tibetan in it. It's wonderful for them. And they have developed many, many, many Tibetan websites, among which some are dedicated only to Tibetan literature and culture, quite a number of them, to the point that at the beginning I could really every day sit down and look and say, okay, what do they write? What have they written today? But now it's impossible. It's like 40 new poems every day, wow. So I can't. And unfortunately, we're very few in the world who really have an interest in this fascinating world. So it's too much for me. I can't keep track. So what are the topics? What do they deal with, these new artists? They celebrate Tibet's unique ecosystem, mountains and lakes, and Tibetan's unity, I should have said, within China. Mm-hmm. So I, from what I see, the more as time goes by, they tend to really focus only on Tibet, and celebrating the mountains and the lake and whatever is also a way of saying we're different. Mm-hmm. And never talk about Beijing. A young man has just published an MA in Tibetan in Beijing about Lhasa in Tibetan poetry, the town Lhasa. He's shown an increased explosion of Lhasa-related poems. And in the 1990s and recently. And I don't think there's one poem about Beijing. So complete ignorance, deliberate ignorance of the other with a capital O. The third generation, this group of poets, they have developed a big focus on expressing their individual feelings. So you have both this interest for the collectivity of Tibetans, uniqueness of Tibetans within China, but also focus on oneself. Who am I? What am I feeling? Which was not the case in the 1980s and 1990s. Love is a big, big, big topic. negative feelings is even bigger. So it's very gloomy. This is maybe another reason why I don't want to read all these poems. because they're so sad, you know. These people, mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. you can easily understand why. Anguish, sadness, solitude, confusion. It's a recurrent mood. They talk a lot about contemporary society, especially in short stories. Mm-hmm. And in the contemporary, there's a lot of criticism. They talk about, it's less simple than it sounds. There's also a big emphasis on the struggle between tradition and modernity, because, you know, within the frame of China, they are seen as backwards. Tibetans are backwards, and Chinese or Han Chinese are advanced. So this is like what they've heard for the last 60 years. So of course, you know, it seeps into your mind, and of course you think you're backward, and you think the others are advanced. And it really, in the novels and short stories, you find a lot of that. So usually you have a father and a struggling with his son for the choice of a career. The father wants the son to be a monk, and the son wants to be a businessman, or he wants to live in a town. And you have a mother who's struggling with her daughter, and sometimes the daughter has to struggle with both her parents, the choice of her partner. It's not about career, it's about marriage, you know. The mother wants her to marry this and that person. The daughter wants to have free choice of marriage. That was another kind of trope of, you know, being backward is not having choice in marriage, in your love life. So it surfaces again and again in the contemporary poetry, short stories. And, okay, so this is what they talk about, and what they don't talk about is the Dalai Lama. You never ever hear the word. Actually, you never hear it. There are many words for the Dalai Lama in Tibetan. They don't say Dalai Lama, but they say other things. And when I come back from a stay in Tibet, like 2 months in Tibet, I come back, and it takes me time to be able to say it myself, because there's such a big pressure on not pronouncing the word of the person about whom everybody's thinking all the time, and all hopes rely on him, you know, but you can't talk about him. Free Tibet is another complete taboo expression anyway. It can send you to jail, so you don't talk about it. Exile community, you just pretend there's no exile community. You know, some Tibetans live in exile in northern India. This is where the Dalai Lama is. It's very limited. It's only 3% of the population, but they do a lot for, you know, a lot of activism. And you'd never, I can tell you, my students and I are preparing a kind of a vocabulary, like basic vocabulary, French, Tibetan, English. And we have several sections, and we try to put examples. And one example was, which we made up and asked him to check with his Tibetan counterparts in Lhasa. We were in France making these vocabularies, sent him our material in Lhasa, and he had to test it with his people around him to check if it was okay. So one sentence to illustrate whatever was, he's currently in Dharamsala. Maybe it was currently he wanted to, you know, to show how to use it or whatever. And stupidly enough, we made up this sentence. And he sent it back to us and said, thank you for the, he was very angry because the word Dharamsala was included in the document that we sent him, the attached document. So this is to show you how restricted it is, you know, and watched. Democracy is another swear word, you can't use it. You can start using it if you're Chinese, but not if you're a Tibetan. No, it's true. So how do they, this will, maybe you will see, compare with how the Koreans, minority in Japan, tried to bring to the front in their writings the problematic topics that they want to talk about, otherwise they don't create art anyway. There's polysemy and opacity, especially in poetry. I will show you a poem. And you can see, I think, I don't need any footnotes. I think everybody will understand what it means. So playing on polysemy, playing on opacity. So it's like, do I understand right that it really means that he wants Tibet to be free? Or is it just my impression? You can't really pinpoint and say, this is a political poem. You know, it's too blurred. It's about a bird who can't escape from his cage, and this kind of thing. Oh, it's just a bird, just a cage, you know. Why do you interpret it like that? In songs and poetry, you also have a lot of metaphors, which is, opacity was more lack of very precise meaning. Second was more like, metaphors like what I've just said. So silence about Chinese and Chinese policies. So if you know, the first part, the first group I mentioned, the elegiacs, the ones who pay homage to the state. They just celebrate China all the time. If you look at these poems, it looks like they are not in China. There's nothing. No hint at any policy. Just an ideal world without China. So we can call it a strategic essentialism. This is a concept that was developed to talk about minority groups, you know, trying to put forward their very unique identity so as to get benefit or special treatment, right? Mm-hmm. So they kind of reduced their identity to a very simple and unified and illusory, you know, it's an illusion that it's so pure and unified and mono factor. So the pure Tibet is, you know what I mean? It's this is for me, it's part of this strategic essentialism. Mm. Something that I hinted at is also, it is a kind of a strategy. Thanks to the liberalization of Chinese economy, in 1992, Deng Xiaoping declared, it's called his Southern Tour, he went to Shenzhen, and he declared that becoming rich was the thing, you know. So they called it capitalist with socialist characteristic, nobody knows what it is actually, but it's just capitalism, pure capitalism, right? Ultra-capitalism, as long as you don't threaten the state. So it means private enterprises were able to be set up, not always backed by a state enterprise. As long as you have money, and as long as you don't talk about ultra problematic things, you can do it. Well, the Tibetans are very rural, herders and farmers, so they're not that rich, and they're among the poorest in China. But you have some, you have sponsors among the business community. People who make business, there's quite a big trend in being sponsors for singers, you know, printing VCDs, DVDs, supporting book publication. And this is how they reach financial autonomy, which gives them a little freedom to express what they want. Where am I? Oh, sorry. I just wanted to show you, it's not really proper here, contemporary art as well in Tibet. But this contemporary art is maybe the less... Contemporary art is not very engaged politically in Tibet.
Do you mean visual art?
Visual art. Okay. Visual art. This doesn't fit, so I will. So here's the poem. I very, very, very... translated yesterday from my French translator to the English, so please forgive me, you know, I don't have the original here, but okay, there's a poem, it's called The Uninvited Guests, so already from the beginning, I think you know who they mean, right? And so maybe we can read it, or?
Sure.
I can let you read it.
So we read right across,
yes, A, B,
ignoring
C, D,
the spaces?
There are spaces in the original. It was
right.
A, B, C, D with spaces. So I tried to...
But we still read left to right all the way.
You read it
later.
Someone came saying I'm the master of beaming.
Okay.
The gun is in the hand. I'll let you read it.
Sure, thank you.
Actually, it's a poem by my colleague Dorji, who was here yesterday. Mm-hmm. He's written heaps of poems like that, and which are just beyond, just at the border. You know, he doesn't say anything. You can't arrest someone for having written that because he hasn't actually said who the guests were.
Right.
Everybody understands, but it's too silent about who the guests are. For him to get into trouble.
Did he publish this poem
in
Tibetan?
Yes.
And in what sort of...
independent publishing, same. You know,
so like one of those journals you were talking about, those literary journals?
Journals, yes. And now he has this collection of poems. He has published two collections of his own poetry.
Okay.
It's a privately... supposedly Tibetans can only publish through official publishing houses.
Okay.
According to the law, but there are loopholes, and they've managed to publish a number of books without the state approval.
Okay.
It's not completely forbidden. I mean, if they want to make trouble for him, they can take that as an excuse and say, you published this book without,
right.
Not through a public or state publishing house. So far, it's okay. I think they are quite wary or cautious making trouble to people who are famous outside. This is something we learned in the last years.
Right.
People who are famous outside are like becoming invulnerable or untouchable.
So that you could add that to your list of how they cope. Become famous outside China and have external supporters who make
them
famous.
Yes. Yeah. But this is not in their capacity. It all depends on us.
Yes.
And,
when poems like this get out,
yes.
And people in China read them,
mm-hmm.
I guess it would be a Chinese translation. These would be written in Tibetan.
Well, that's the thing. Not that many Tibetan written material gets translated into Chinese.
Oh, okay.
So there's a complete cutoff there, or are there any sympathizers in China?
Well, that's. As is the case for you, you know, Tibet has been under Chinese rule for 60 years now.
Yeah.
But education in Tibetan is still possible. So, but you may also live in a family or be in an area of Tibet where you can't have a Tibetan education. You will have to go to a Chinese school. So now there have been generations of Tibetans right from the beginning until now who haven't attended Tibetan schools but Chinese schools. So you have quite a fair number of Tibetans who write in Chinese. The Tibetan writers who write in Chinese are mostly read by Tibetans who read Chinese. So far, it seems I'm not special. This is not my specialty. I have a colleague in France who works on, you know, being Tibetan and writing in Chinese. How can you do that? You know, I mean, what does it mean? And she told me that most of the reading public were educated Tibetans, and that the Chinese audience was quite indifferent to Tibetans, to Chinese written Tibetan works, or you know, Tibetan works written in Chinese, because it's hard to imagine how Tibetans are seen in China. Here, they are like, we're not in the middle way. You know, here, people just love Tibetans. You know, they are wonderful, and they are so nonviolent, and da, 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 and so kind, and beautiful people. And in China, it's just completely the opposite. Barbarous, violent, uneducated, stupid, smelling, whatever. Completely despised as a sub category of human beings.
Universally despised? All Chinese?
Well, this is the Chinese rhetoric, you know. We are the Chongguo, you know, we are the center of the world, and just around us are just minor categories of humanity or culture. Tibetans are a bit different because they had a state, they have a script, 1,400 years, it's among the oldest in Asia. They have developed a special kind of Buddhism. So it's a bit of a problem, you know, the Tibetans. They don't fit in exactly in the category of barbaric minority. But for certain aspects, they are still very rural herders. Being a herder when you're a Chinese sedentary person who believes in agriculture and then who believes in socialism and then, you know, in being part of, you know, a city as the epitome of progress. Being a herder means being completely backward. I was in a museum in China 10 years ago, anthropological museum, and they ranked their minorities according to development stage. Wonderful. Just imagine who was at the top and who was at the bottom, you know. People, you know, hunter-gatherers, it's terrible. And next came the herders. They say they're roaming around, you know. It's like they can't do better. They'd love to, but they can't because they haven't developed enough. So the Tibetan, the Chinese view on Tibetan is it's very disparaging. The Tibetans are really very backward. But now you have a fringe, you know, like some Chinese avant-garde artists, writers, painters, filmmakers who are fascinated by Tibet. This is You know, they still have a culture, we have nothing. We just love money. They know that there's something beyond this ultra-capitalist world. They have an anchoring in their culture. They have traditions, we've lost them. And sometimes they come to Lhasa, set up bars, and mix with Tibetans. You know, the paintings I showed, this is a group that was set up in Lhasa of a mix of Tibetan Chinese artists who just love art. They don't care about whether you're Tibetan, Chinese, or whatever. Just, and they come to Lhasa, the Chinese one. Why? Because they think there's something there. So there's a growing fascination for Tibetan within the artistic community. Plus, growing fascination for Tibetan Buddhism, which is very popular among certain sections of the Chinese population. And you have lamas, spiritual masters, Tibetan, going to Beijing, Shanghai, making lots of money with Chinese disciples. Mm. Bringing them to Tibet, building up new temples. This is very new. This is about in the last 10 years or something. But then in 2008, there was a big crisis all over Tibet. And although, okay, we've heard of 150 to 200 demonstrations by Tibetans. A few turned violent. One in Lhasa, a few others in some places. And the Chinese government, who has this monopoly on media, has only talked about the one who turned most violent in Lhasa. It's become like 9/11 in the States, you know, like March the 14th. People know what it is. March the 14th is when Tibetan people killed Chinese people in Lhasa. Mm-hmm. So it kind of destroyed or ruined the growing sympathy or interest that the your average Chinese, I'm not sure, but the upper strata was developing for Tibetans. Now, even those who were quite sympathetic for Tibet have begun to lose or to be skeptical about Tibetans because of the massive state propaganda. Mm-hmm. Of course, you have the ones who know it's not true, the ones who live in Tibet, the ones who have Tibetan friends. But for those for whom it was still some kind of a hazy thing, Tibet, these ones are disillusioned. So. It might take time, but nobody bothers to learn Tibetan among them, so they never accept these kind of works.
Looking at this poem, it strikes me as somehow resembling a Chinese poems of the revolutionary period, uh-huh. You know, the suffering of the peasants, mm-hmm. Their exploitation, and calling Chinese to support the movement. Mm-hmm. Socialism. Mm-hmm. So if a Chinese read this, I would think that they would understand it immediately because it has that direct.
But they would understand it as the Chinese being the guests?
Yeah.
They would?
Well, don't you think?
I don't know. Hmm. Because the Chinese people have been brought up with this idea that they have liberated Tibetans, that Tibetans are so thankful. They haven't got a clue about how discontent the Tibetans are.
Really?
They haven't got a clue.
Wow.
There are two topics about which you can't talk when you're in China, Taiwan and Tibet. And Taiwan is even worse. Tibet is even worse because they're not ethnical Chinese.
Yes.
Yeah. So imagine, it's already problematic.
Yeah.
So they have liberated. You know, I've met some Chinese who came from mainland China. Who are in the West, educated. You can talk about they all want democracy. They all know that the Chinese Communist Party is rotten and to its core and that. But Tibet will always be part of China.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's I think I've met one Chinese who told me, I met a Tibetan who was for Tibetan independence. Well, I would be very sad, but maybe. And I was like, wow.
Yeah.
But he's one among come up with the topic very often anyway, but I know from discussions with others that Tibet is part of China, period.
Yeah.
We don't discuss that.
Yeah, the comparative, paralyzed you was when I was in Indonesia in 1999, and even among all the very progressive NGOs, but you know, when Timor came up for the referendum, I was just amazed. It was part of Indonesia, and there was that counter discourse. Indonesia didn't have the kind of effective repression that China had, but it was part of it, and the nationalism just came surging out of people who were so critical of the state in every other
same.
Way.
Absolutely,
you know, and I
see
that. But there were other places like Aceh because the war had been going on. There was a little bit more give on that, but with Timor, it was part of it, and you know, it was the steps towards the disintegration of the nation. You couldn't have that.
It's interesting, Aceh. You could talk about it because there had been some conflict.
Yes, because the conflict had been much more
visible, yeah.
and because the war had been going on for a longer time, the resistance was much stronger. So there was a sense of the contestation being much more public, right? And
I think it's interesting. Yeah, with Tibet. Tibetans don't express anything, so there is no counter discourse for the Chinese public.
Yeah.
You know,
and it was also where the state was more effective in the repression and the military control. For its particular histories, was having much more effectiveness with resistance and received a lot more attention internationally as well.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yes. Very good parallel. Okay, so there should have been Tibetan on the right side, but anyway. This is just what I found in February 2010. Very tense faces all around us, era of red wind. Red wind means both tempest, and it can be understood as communism, of course. Aggression of tempests, black wind holes. Why is it that this darkness can never be dispelled? I made my mistake. Okay, I mean, everybody understands. I mean, you have a lot of climate-related, weather-related problems like that. It always rains and snows, and there's a lot of wind in there. So the sun never shines in Tibet.
Quick question. If a Tibetan is writing in Chinese, are they less free to say things
Supposedly, yes,
than if a Tibetan writes in Tibetan?
Yes.
Okay.
The problem with the Tibetans writing in Tibetan is that there's so much of it.
Yeah.
And so few Chinese can read Tibetan, and still few Tibetans who can read Tibetan to that level
are also
they call it gonyiba, two-headed, you know, like collaborators.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So if you are really well versed in Tibetan, your allegiance is to Tibet.
Right.
You don't usually belong to the police, or you know what I mean.
Yes.
So they have too little people who can read Tibetan and are ready to denounce their co-citizen, and but for Chinese, yes, my colleague who works on Chinese language, Tibetan literature says that, there's much more surveillance for Chinese.
How about the young people, is their language Chinese primarily or?
No, primarily at home it's always Tibetan, unless the parents are very educated and cadres, high cadres, and they want the children to speak Chinese right from the start to have a better chance in the future. But it's in town and it's quite limited. Usually, people would live with their grandparents, everything, so the grandparents wouldn't speak a word of Chinese anyway. So they would speak Tibetan at home, and depending on the school they go to, they either learn Tibetan or Chinese. At first they can learn both in some schools. Sometimes it's only Tibetan, sometimes it's only Chinese. Mm-hmm. But when they reach secondary school, high schools, there's more chances that they do Chinese than Tibetan. More
so some of those writers I mentioned here studied in different provinces.
Yes.
And then studied in Chinese.
Yes. Yes.
And then come back to Tibetan.
Well, very few of them. Once they've been brought up in Chinese, although they may develop a strong Tibetan awareness, as you know, like Öser, Weser, and Yidam Tsering and others. Possibly for some of them, it's just because they've been educated in Chinese, they have this kind of schizophrenic attitude towards them, and they really develop a very strong Tibetan identity, but very few manage to learn the Tibetan script after that. They can, like Öser, this woman, she has learned how to speak it quite lately in her life. Her language was Chinese all the time. And parallel phenomenon. The more she could learn to speak Tibetan, it coincided, of course, with her desire to learn to speak Tibetan quite fluently. She's still not very absolutely fluent. Came with her raising awareness of being Tibetan and being a Buddhist at the same time. So all these came together. So maybe we can end with the activists. So they're the fourth categories, and the ones who tread the line. Tread the line? Mm-hmm. So Tashi Tandrup, Singer, sorry, you know, I did that. I prepared it yesterday at sort of midnight, so there are a few things wrong here. He sang 4 political songs, and he got, he was released a few, like 1 week ago.
Really?
Mm-hmm. He was.
He's the one who did the song,
2008. Yes, he was welcomed back home as a hero.
Yeah, okay.
We read on the internet. Mm-hmm. After his time in jail. So here's the song, at least it's one part. It's called Torture Without Trace. Okay, his songs are too clear to be accepted. First, a statue for my brother who hasn't returned from afar. He's the Dalai Lama.
Okay.
Yeah. But then this is okay. It could be his brother, right?
Right. Yeah.
Second, the pain because there is no harmony for people. Third, that's another critique of the Tibetan, of the Chinese state, because they always talk about, the more they talk about harmony among the people, it means the more trouble there is. Yeah. They need to promote harmony all the time because there's no harmony. Third, the occupation and denial of freedom. Occupation and denial of freedom for Tibetans. So that's too much, that's too much. And torture without trace. And he has 4 stanzas like that, equally clear. Mm-hmm. Jam Yang Ki, she was arrested for 1 month for revealing state secrets, and that's, she's a woman, she's, okay, we know her, she was in the States in 2006, and I think this helped her get out quickly, because she was very visible. The dean of the university she had been invited to wrote a letter to the local authorities, etc. We Tibetologists are very close to these people. Mm-hmm. I mean, we didn't know she was going to be arrested in 2000, I mean, at that time. But anyway, we are really on good terms with these intellectuals. We highly value them. So we are very, I know my Chinese Sinologist colleagues are not that active to support, like Liu Xiaobo, Nobel Peace Prize. There's a French Association of Chinese Language Teachers. Only 20 of them signed a petition to support, ask for the release of Liu Xiaobo. Whereas in 2008, when there was repression in Tibet, the whole, I think maybe everybody but 5 people in the Tibetological world, Tibetan studies specialists, we all sent a letter to Hu Jintao asking for leniency and please try to understand. And we are, we are academic, but we are very humanly related to the people whom we follow. So it helps in that case. Anyway, Jam Yang Ki was released.
This is an area we're very interested in. How the government responds, or how your unanimity as Tibetologists in opposition to government policies in China, how this works, if it has all positive results, or some positive and some negative results, how do you assess your impact?
I think it has positive results because, at least, I mean, this is the, I'm talking just about, I can't generalize, the Tibetan case. Tibetology has become a heavily funded field of research in China. They have a Tibetology center in Beijing. It's all political. We know what it's, people are put there to prove how China, how Tibet has benefited from the inclusion in China. But they pretend they are researchers. We pretend we think they are researchers. We invite them to... no, because we know there's double talk here. Some people have to work in these things. And if they can do a little thing, it's fair enough. We know the rules, So it's okay. We can't ostracize them. We had a choice, The International Association of Tibetan Studies... Usually, I'm not part of the board, but I go to the meetings. It was in Vancouver last year. So what do we do? Should we, when the paper is, the dissent is obviously pure propaganda, political, do you just don't accept it? Do we, but if we know that we know the person, it's a small community, we know that the person who sent this paper has to deliver this kind of paper, but it will be beneficial for him or her to come to Vancouver, share with us. Be with us just even for 10 minutes, go out. It's difficult now to go out of China when you're Tibetan because you don't get a passport. The Chinese government won't give a passport to their Tibetan citizens. They don't want them to go out. So if they are already part of this elite, they have a better chance to go out. Of course, they have compromised. Otherwise, they wouldn't be part of the elite. But still, they're Tibetans. And apart from a few hopeless cases, we know most of them feel desperate about the situation. So we decide to invite them or to let them in. And we hope that through discussion and through their just listening to what people here say and which they never listen to, hopefully that will build up confidence for them to show a little bit more, not resistance, it's hard to be resistant, but Anyway, and you know, to strengthen their will to promote or to be really to be not too obedient to the Chinese state, or to bring in new ideas that they wouldn't have been able to bring in if they hadn't come out of the country. Mm. Well, something like that. We're not expecting much bigger results than that.
Well, I mean, you mentioned that the Jiang Yanqi, is that right?
Yeah.
That she may have been released earlier because mm-hmm. she's known outside.
Yes, that's a different thing. She's not part of academia.
But mm-hmm. yeah, are there people, not in academia, mm-hmm. but people in Tibet, who, because they're known outside of Tibet, have gotten in trouble?
No, not that I. They always try to. It's interesting, you know. Then there's another case, very recent, last year. Shogdung, I sent you this. Shogdung, you
yeah.
very kindly translated
yeah.
very quickly
yeah, yeah.
from Tibetan, French into
yeah.
English. It's a comment on 2008. It's a book about the 2008
yes.
event. It's
yeah.
very open
yeah,
and
yeah.
frank,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah, yeah.
He got into trouble, he got into jail.
Yeah.
We knew him. There was pressure from. We pressurized, or we got in touch with the embassies. Actually, it was not through academia, but being an academic gives us credit. So all of us who knew him relayed some information about him to our like French. I was in touch with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the China Department, and this person in charge, and my Tibetan studies specialist colleague, Tibetan studies specialist in Germany would have done the same in Germany, and also we got in touch with the French embassy in Beijing, and we raised his case, made a very nice file about him, and blah, blah, blah. And he got released after 5 months after having been charged or threatened to be charged with being inciting or
yeah,
promoting
yeah,
separatism, which is a big
big
thing. Big charge.
So
I can't tell you A plus B equals C, but I'm quite sure if there hadn't been any support, and the academic support here was indirect, you know, nobody apart from you, and it's on the tape, but please don't let it out.
No,
nobody knows that we've done that. You know, we keep
yeah.
it very secret. But we have credit, and we use it, and we don't use it randomly, you know, only things of which we're very sure,
mm-hmm.
and it usually works because we have good relay in French embassies or German embassies.
I guess I'm asking because I'm remembering back in the bad old days, quote unquote, in China, when if a foreigner, a Chinese-speaking foreigner was in China, and they visited
mm-hmm.
a family,
mm-hmm.
and then they left,
mm-hmm.
within an hour,
mm-hmm.
there would be a police,
police
would visit the same family.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What did you talk about?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you tell them anything about that?
Mm-hmm.
And that family would immediately be put on a kind of, a list
mm-hmm.
of suspects.
Mm-hmm.
So some well-meaning foreigners were
yeah.
going around learning about China like this and not realizing, perhaps they didn't realize,
mm-hmm.
the problems they were creating.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm wondering if anything like that is true.
Absolutely. Tibet. We know that when we are in Tibet, if we go to families, then the police will come. You said good old days. Bad old days. But this is bad current days in
yeah,
Tibet.
Yeah.
It still happens in Tibet. For instance, as far as I'm concerned, I try not to go into people's house. Anyway, in the Lhasa area, Tibet Autonomous Region, you're not allowed to sleep at a private person's house. You have to be in a hotel. Specific regulation. It's for your safety, of course. So, okay, we abide by the law. We don't stay at families. But we know that, a student of mine was somewhere in Amdo, which is usually more lenient for that kind of thing. And she arrived in February for New Year last year, and next morning she was summoned to the police, and she had arrived at night time. Nobody knew how she doesn't know how they knew, but she was warned that she was not to take any pictures, she was not to go outside the family, she was not to talk about this and that and this and that. So it's still very tense. So we are very extremely careful, that's for sure, we who know the situation, and we are really worried about these well-meaning foreigners who go around spreading Dalai Lama pictures and everything, and these guys are crazy. So we're different from them, okay? But what I wanted to say about Shogdung is that his family had been told. Shogdung is the man who wrote about the 2008 crisis.
Right.
He gave his own analysis. I met his family in July. Actually, I didn't want to meet them because I thought I was so, you say, conspicuous, so visible. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I was in town, but waiting to settle down, and just, oh, just by chance, meeting them in a restaurant or something like that. No, by unluck, sheer unluck, I met their the daughter of their friends, and, oh, you're here, I'll phone my dad, da-da-da, okay. And the dad said on the phone, come and see me immediately. So he was best friend of Shogun. So I went, you know, I thought, okay, he knows the risks, you know, I didn't do anything. He calls me in, so I go. He said, you have to talk to his wife, you have to talk to his daughter, you have to take these documents, we have to talk about him outside. So I was summoned again to talk to the wife and everything. And I said, well, we talked for 5 hours in a restaurant. I said, you think nobody knows I'm in this restaurant for 5 hours with you? I mean, it doesn't make sense.
It's on YouTube.
Yeah, it could be. I said, maybe I can leave the restaurant a little bit before you. No, we live together. Okay, we take the same taxi. Okay, whatever, you know.
Well, he's already in jail, I guess.
No, but the family is not in jail, And they didn't know where he was. I mean, okay. They thought he was in that jail, and he would go every day to that jail, but they were not even sure he was in this very jail. No, it was very critical. And they told me, you know, the police told us that we shouldn't talk to foreigners. Not to let anyone, any foreigner, talk about that. But this means we have to talk to foreigners, you know. If they don't want us to talk to foreigners, it means that it's a danger for them. So we will go against it, and we will talk to you because we know it's beneficial for our dad and husband.
Okay.
You see, so I mean, they're quite bold, and they know how to understand the rhetoric behind. You know, they read between the lines, and surely enough, after two or three months. Was released. So far, Tibetans who have gone outside, as long as they haven't talked publicly about Dalai Lama, independence, democracy in Tibet, human rights, it's okay. It's better if they go at once, as I said, because we have pictures, we know what they do, we can describe them, and people in Beijing, French embassy, etc., can. You know, we had someone at French embassy who called the court in. To follow the Shogdong case, and said, I want to be at the trial. I'm from the French embassy, I want to be at the trial. So it seems that, you know, it's good. And Dorje, the filmmaker, as soon as we returned to France, he has never really met the people at the French Ministry of Foreign Affairs who deal with China. We want him to meet them now, because he's returning to China soon. He's still making film. He's making a film about mining in Tibet. Land rights, eviction, So, and he got it. Yeah, so, and he still wants to do it. He knows there is, you know, he was born there, he knows exactly what he's doing, but he got this phone call from the, you know, Chinese police on Wednesday morning. His brother was summoned, his brother still lives there. His brother was summoned 1 month ago and interrogated about Dorje's activities in France. What does he do? So he's really being watched now. So as soon as we fly back to France in the evening, we meet people from the, we have dinner with the people of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in charge of China, so that they know him physically. You know, it's not only a name on a paper. Oh, this guy was arrested. He's not a French citizen, but he was in France. We know him. I think it's quite important.
What about these, you call them crazies, the ones who go there and put up pictures of the Dalai Lama? I mean, if the do-gooders.
Do-gooders, yes.
Call them? I mean, who are they? What effect are they having? When you look at them, what problems do you see?
I think they haven't got a clue about the environment in China. They know about, they come from Dharamsala. They are not Tibetans. The Tibetans, it's Westerners. The do-gooders, Western, white people.
Yeah,
a few black people. White, Western, American, French, Australian, whatever. Japanese, not that much.
And they're completely independent, or are they there with some organization?
I think they're independent. And they haven't got a clue how repressive the system is. I met that. Was he Spanish? I was in Tibet 2008, but before everything started, January 2008. And this silly guy, a hero, of course, you know, a hero of Tibetan, he's going to free Tibet, I guess. He arrived, and I met him in the morning, and he already sounded a bit dubious to me, like, I'm going there, you know, I don't, okay, you can't travel outside Lhasa without a permit now. I mean, it's very, very, very restricted area. Mm-hmm. So if you go, you want to go out of Lhasa municipality, which is like 20 kilometers away, you need a guide, a permit, you need to say, to tell the police every day where you're sleeping, where you're going. They have checkpoints checking if the car has, it's crazy, wow. It's absolutely crazy, you know, the checkpoints, so that they check if, when you stopped here, let's say, look, your car stopped at 12 here, you should be there at 2, right? And if you're not there at 2, it means you've been somewhere around. Where have you been? It's really increasingly repressive. And you have to, when you sleep there, you said, I will sleep there at night. The police knows that you're expected, and your guide, you can't go without a guide and a driver. Your guide has to report, bring your passport to the police and say, yes, he's or she has arrived, and da-da-da, we're leaving tomorrow. So, hopeless. I mean, really, I don't travel anymore in Tibet anyway. And so this guy, of course, would not accept the situation, fair enough. He said, oh, I don't care, I'll take a bus and go and by myself. You can't take a bus. You have to take a car with a driver and a guide. No, well, I don't care. You know, I will. Oh, okay, fair enough. Next day, he was back in Lhasa. Like, oh, it didn't work. Ah, surprise. Anyway, and then he comes back in the evening. He said, look at my hat. And I mean, there were so few foreigners, I kept coming across him. Right? And he had a Tibetan right, freedom, you know, independence on his hat. I said, you're crazy or what? You know, this guy can go to jail for having written independence in Tibetan on your hat. He thought it was kind of fancy, you know. And I said, yes, I'm supposed to meet him tomorrow morning. I said, don't meet him tomorrow morning, just forget about this guy. And he forgets about you. He was just kind enough. You know, that's a problem, you know. The Tibetans are too kind at sometimes. You want me to write independence? Okay. And you can't say no, you know. And of course I met him again in the next day. And he said, oh, he didn't come to the meeting. Yeah, I go to jail and see if he's there, you know. And I guess he didn't come anyway because he was not that stupid. So this is a do-gooder. You know? He's complete independent do-gooder. I don't think people come. There is very little networking or organization. You see how things are being watched. There are, you know, neighborhood committees who tell who's where and everything, watching people all the time. You know, in China, there hasn't been resistance to the Communist Party, like a parallel political party that's been able to come up in 60 years. Mm-hmm. So how could it happen in Tibet anyway? There's nothing. Yeah. It's impossible. This is resistance. This is how you resist. Plus the Dalai Lama always calls for non-violence.
Yeah.
So Tibetans, they have no weapon anyway. They have no money to buy weapons. And the Dalai Lama keeps telling them, okay, you can buy weapons and see what happens to you, you know? You just raise your gun and you have like thousands of army coming to you. So just think before you do something like that, okay? So this is how they resist.
Are there any minority groups who are inspired by Tibetans?
In China?
Yeah.
Well, I think there are another two problematic minority groups in China, only two. You know, there are 56
yes.
ethnic groups, 55.
Officially recognized.
Officially recognized, yeah, from 400 to 56. Yeah.
Yes.
And among the 55 minority groups, from my understanding, and maybe you know more than me, it's Mongolians and Uyghurs who are problematic.
Yeah.
Mongolians, but Mongolians are completely drowned,
swamped.
You know, like in Inner Mongolia, where most Mongolians live, the population, the rate is 15% of Mongolian, 85% of Han Chinese. And education is in Mongolian is not as thriving as in Tibetan language. So identity doesn't only come through language, but it does help, you know, for you to feel something different, you know. So on the Mongolian side, it's very quiet, peaceful on the Mongolian side. Actually, there was a Mongolian from China who came to talk in Switzerland to the what's it called? The autonomous, the autochthonous group. There's someone, an anthropologist in France who works about it. I think you might be interested to know what she does. You know, there's a body in Switzerland for representing people who are not nations or First Nations or minority groups who are not represented officially by their state.
Mm-hmm.
And what is it called? Autochthonous. Da, 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 da. And the, you know, like American Indians and Yanomamis and whatever. Tibetans are not part of it. And a Mongolian came to talk one day on this, they have yearly committees talking about their rights and how it's, you know, the advance in their right or not, and the conflict with the state and everything. And this Mongolian who talked about the lack of rights for Mongolians, and he returned to, states are allowed to send observers. So you have the minority groups who elect people. So she's looking at these French anthropologists, these elite, who are the representative of the, how are these minority groups formed? And who do they send as leaders, and what does it impact does it have on them and the community and the state, of course. And so you have many state observers. And China used to ignore these kind of minority things, but they are sending more and more people now. So there are many Chinese state representatives observing the discussions, because I think they're taking ideas maybe on how to treat minorities, maybe. Good ideas, of course. And the Mongolian guy who came from China talked about the position of Mongolians, and he returned to China, and he was unheard of. I mean, nobody knows what happened to him after that. So it's all quiet and peaceful on the Mongolian front, but for a few activists, maybe. But it's not as big as in Tibet at all. And the Uyghurs are very problematic. Yeah. There are Muslims, Turkic-speaking people, and in a much dire condition than Tibetans. Population-wise, they're really swamped, more than 50%. There are very few places where they are now a majority. In 60 years, everything has changed, not in Tibet. Because the ecosystem is also different. You can settle more easily there if you're not mm-hmm. part of it than in Tibet. Mm-hmm. And they are quite violent. They resort to violence. Well, so to speak, you know, I mean, as far as they can. No, they have no leaders telling them don't be violent, contrary to Tibetans. But I know that in the West, in France, or Uyghurs and Tibetan activists talk to each other. Mm-hmm. And in a way, Uyghurs are admirers of Tibetans, but quite jealous, because the Tibetan get all the attention, yeah. sympathy, and Uyghurs, because they are Muslims,
yes.
feel, yes. yeah, I guess, you know. Yeah. Especially since 9/11, yeah. Because they've been labeled as a terrorist group in China, anyway, mm-hmm. some of them. The Tibetans, not yet, but I think it might be coming. Yes. I don't know, maybe we can just keep talking informally, yeah. and if you have questions.
I just was going to ask about Tsering Dondrup. He was kicked out of Tibet, you mean?
No, of his job.
Okay.
It's interesting. I know Tsering Dondrup very well. He's a good old friend, and he works for the archive, administration. So he has a lot of problematic historical documents in hand.
Yes.
So it was very precious that he had a high position. It's a local archive, it's not a big thing, it's not like a provincial ones, it's very local. And he used it to write his novel. He used the archives, we talked, we were good friends, and he used also all these discussions with his friends to describe in this novel, mm-hmm. The Red Wind. Once again, there's a Red Wind.
Okay,
the 1958 uprising of Tibetans mm-hmm. in this area. Mm-hmm. It was both based on
yeah.
archives. I sent you a...
the extract. In fact, I wanted to ask you about mm-hmm. that, because the juxtaposition of the two extracts is quite interesting. The one by Shogdong, mm-hmm. I don't know, I don't have the right terminology here, but you folks can help me, but it's much more... just kind of an essay style, I would call it, right?
It's an essay style.
It's like a bit like journalism or essay.
Yeah,
or, and the... the other one is clearly a novel, the one by Tsering Dondrup. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about how the state perceives the two different ways of telling a story? Does it see one as more threatening than the other, or more problematic, or different? And a related point is, I mean, I didn't read the whole novel, obviously, but I thought from what you told us that the Tsering Dondrup's novel is about the 1958 uprising and about the Cultural Revolution,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And the excerpt you gave us,
mm-hmm.
that's after the 1958.
It's just right after.
Right after, when these people have been
arrested,
put in the labor
camps,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So why is that so problematic? Because at various times the Chinese state has itself denounced its own treatment of Tibetans, like in, you know, like
yes.
with in 1980,
yes.
You know, in, around then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this isn't talking about contemporary Tibet, right?
No, it's not, 50 years back.
Yeah, it's a long time
taboo.
Ago. It's
yes.
still taboo.
Yes.
So if you could talk about those two things,
mm-hmm.
the perception of the state of these two different forms of storytelling
mm-hmm.
and how it understands those relative to
mm-mm.
the concerns it has. And well, then this question of why it's still so problematic. I mean, as you were saying, we had a chance to talk on the drive to York last night, but, you know, in China now, you can publish novels and poems about the Cultural Revolution
yeah.
and about the horrors you've suffered or people suffered because of the extremes of the Red Guard and of the arbitrariness of state action. And yet in Tibet, you can't, it would appear, talk about
mm-hmm.
the Cultural
mm-hmm.
Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's
yeah.
it's like two different... regimes about freedom of expression, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
quite interesting. So if you
mm-hmm.
could talk about those two things.
So as for the first point,
yeah.
I'm not sure. There are not enough instances of problematic novels versus problematic essays and how has the state reacted each
mm-hmm.
time. I know that the problematic essay here by Xiao Dong
mm-hmm.
was translated into Chinese immediately.
By whom?
By the Chinese government.
Ah.
It was published in an underground kind of... The good thing about Chinese being... I'm sorry for leaving my academic garb aside, being so arrogant, is that they don't bother to learn Tibetan, right? So you can bring them this kind of book and ask them to copy it in 4,000 copies, and they will, because they haven't got a clue what's inside, you know. Anyway, you're just such a fool, you know, being a Tibetan, what kind of interesting thing, and maybe it's prayers, you know, Buddhist or whatever. So, yes, we copy it. That's a good thing for Tibetan. You know, they manufactured Tibetan flags in Guangzhou.
Really?
In 2008, Chinese people, not knowing it was Tibetan flag, made money.
That's capitalism.
Yeah. So, you know, these Tibetan flags suddenly appeared in 2008
yeah.
in demonstration. Some of them you can see they were hand painting, but some of them were really neatly done. And of course, the Chinese government was very quick pointing, this is a conspiracy, you know, coming from the West, they were shipped in, it's a proof that it's a Dalai Lama plot. Huh, too bad. There was a New York Times reporter who found out it came from Guangzhou. So anyway.
Everything is made in China.
That's right.
That's right. That's right.
Yes.
That's right.
Probably in Alabama.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But because of the censorship on everything Tibetan, nobody knows what the Tibetan flag looks like apart
right.
from Tibetans. So they manufactured it out of complete ignorance.
Yeah.
So they made this book out of complete ignorance about what the Tibetans couldn't put in it anyway. So, but anyway, the Chinese government heard of that and had it translated very precisely, immediately,
okay.
and it took... This is the reason why... This is a supposition. He was not arrested immediately. Xiao Dong was not arrested immediately after the publication of his book. It took about 6 months, and it's an assumption. It could be that it took 6 months to really come up with a fine translation of this book. Or maybe less time, but... Okay, maybe they didn't react on the very day. Maybe they heard something about a book that everybody wanted to buy because it's a bestseller. You know, this Xiao Dong book. There are now 4 pirate copy version. Pirate?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Circulate. And when I was in Tibet, it was banned last year. And everybody was like, have you read it? It was hidden in the cupboards, you know,
yeah,
when
yeah.
I was with Tibetans. And so it's a hit among Tibetans.
Mm-hmm.
And it must have... triggered some interest in people's, in the authorities' mind, and they had it translated, maybe 1 month after it was published, I don't know, it took some time for translating it. They say they wanted to translating it quite accurately, because if you want to sue him,
mm-hmm.
you have to be very precise about what's written in the book, right? Because he's developing the idea of, he's looking at the events in 2008, and he promotes civil disobedience.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a new concept for Tibetans, they hadn't heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
So he has to explain, so there's a historical background,
mm-hmm.
Thoreau and Gandhi and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So it required some fine translation skills to have exactly what, you know, to put in Chinese exactly what he wanted to say, we guess. So this triggered the state's interest as to the point that it was translated. But for the other one, for Tering Tonjuk, so Songdong was arrested on potential charge of inciting separatism through his book. Whereas Tering Tonjuk, he was arrested or kicked out of his position because his book had no proper ISBN. This is the objection. Right. It's not published according to the laws, whatever the... They didn't mention the content, but it happens often that Tibetans publish through non-official publishing houses. So why was this one picked? Because of the content, of course. But of course, now they're becoming clever. They won't say it's because of the content, because then everybody will be interested in what's inside. Right. So just said, oh, it's a legal thing.
Right, like an accounting error, yeah.
It's difficult for me to say, but how the world reacts to novels and everything. Mm-hmm. But so far, very few writing, fictional writing, have been banned in Tibetan, mm-hmm. as far as I know. Mm-hmm. So why is this specially problematic? Because it's not Cultural Revolution, mm-hmm. it's 1958. Okay. And in 1958 is double taboo in Tibetan and Chinese history. It's the Great Leap Forward. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you still don't talk about the Great Leap Forward in China.
Okay,
you talk about Cultural Revolution, but not the Great Leap Forward. Yeah. Actually, it coincided with the Great Leap Forward in Tibet. Yeah. And the Tibetans in that area and that time had to undergo two hardships, it's catastrophes.
Yeah.
Both the Great Leap Forward plus suppression of very strong suppression of the Tibetan rebellion, so mm-hmm. ethnic problems. Mm-hmm. In some places, and maybe then I can try and explain why these people in AMDO are so active. Mm-hmm. Strangely enough, I think it's connected. In 58, there was, and we don't know anything about it because it's taboo still to talk about it, because of this, the disguise of, it's Great Leap Forward, so we can't talk about it. But there's another problem. It's also a Tibetan-Chinese conflict, right? Mm-hmm. Armed conflict. Mm-hmm. Very, very violent, which occurred all over AMDO, and nobody talks about it because for Tibetans, the big date is 59 when the Dalai Lama left. Mm-hmm. March 59. And March every year, it's better not to be in Lhasa because army is all around in March because they are afraid that Tibetans will mourn for the departure of the Dalai Lama. So in the diasporic and exile mental frame, 59 is the key date. But for AMDO people, it's 58. Don't talk about 59. Because 58 was general upheaval of the Tibetans against the Chinese. It's not only the Dalai Lama and a few followers leaving, a few tens of thousands of people leaving. In Lhasa, there was not much violence. Mm-hmm. There was a little violence in March 59, but no uprising, no popular uprising. In 58, there was a total uprising, up to the point that in some places, if you look at Chinese statistics, before 58, and the next one was 63, the population has been divided by two. So you say, okay, Great Leap Forward. No, it's not Great Leap Forward, because Great Leap Forward meant a diminution by 5% of the population.
Because
in China.
Of the famine.
Because of the famine. Mm-hmm. In some places in Tibet, in Tibetan areas, it's 50%, and male population has decreased a lot. Some people who remember, Dorje, he was born in 63, so when he was 10, or he said there was no male around. When I was 10, no uncle, no grandfather, no father. It was a woman world, because everybody had been killed or was in jail. Mm-hmm. So this awareness of extreme suffering. People talk about mass graves being discovered now, but this is just a rumor, but it could be true because it was really violent. This memory is still alive in people's mind, and I think the reason why people in AMDO are so creative and so engaged, all these people I'm talking about, they come from the same area. There's no one coming from Lhasa. They all come from a very, small corner, it's like one-fourth of the Tibetan area. They know these stories. Their grandfather was killed, their uncle was killed. I mean, it's a miracle they were there. They were born anyway. I mean, there were a few survivors. And Tashi Tundrup, Jamyanki, they all have stories to tell. It reminds me of the Holocaust survivors. Mm-hmm. It's really, and when you read the description of what happened in 58, the camps and everything, mm-hmm. it really strikes, it really reminds you of, you know, Solzhenitsyn, Tillington Troop loves Solzhenitsyn. And it was forbidden in China for a long time, the translation of Solzhenitsyn, but then it was published and he bought it immediately. And as well as 1984, he said, for some reason, the Chinese must have felt so comfortable with themselves, they allowed the publication of 1984. So I bought it immediately. And he said the preprint was very low. It was only 4,000 to 6,000. And he thought, so how come so few Chinese are interested in reading George Orwell 1984? You know, it just completely fits in. This is exactly the world we live in. They should have rushed to it, but 4,000 print run for such a population means they're not that interested in that. So, so the memory goes on. And these people talk about, you know, the song 1958-2008. I think I think talking about history, the more and more they're talking about recent history in the 1958 period. And that's very important in the building up of a collective identity, having suffered, particularly suffered under the Chinese state.
Just since we're on the topic of why it is that so many of these creative people come from Do, could another reason be that...
There's another reason.
Well, I was wondering if it was because until more recently, I was under the impression there was a bit more freedom there express than in the Tibetan Autonomous Region.
Yes, of course, there is. Because for the Chinese government, that's another interesting thing. Yeah. Because they're... Okay, Tibet has been part of China... It varies for 200 years, for 700 years. Now it's from time beyond.
Time immemorial.
So we're not very clear about it. But anyway, it's always been part of China at some point. Yeah. But their vision of Tibet is very reduced. They, as honestly, they know very little about Tibet. They know it was part of China, but apart from that, they don't know much. They reduced Tibet to what is called the Tibet Autonomous Region. So it's half of the big territory I've shown you, the southern half. If you ask for a Chinese, where is Tibet? He say it's this, you know. And say, what about this? No. This is Qinghai. This is Sichuan. This is, you know, Chinese provinces. So there was no Tibet tag on these provinces. So there was not much army, not much surveillance, and Tibetans were more free. Although it's just equally as Tibetan as the rest, there was no stigma on these, you know. So people were more free. Also, education has been thriving in Tibetan language because you have local people. Leaders who believe in Tibetan education. It's really interesting how, I don't know how it is in Canada, but because it's decentralized. So if you have a leader who really wants to support Tibetan education, he can. They don't always want to, but they can. So in these areas, maybe also because of the collective memory of suffering, whatever, there's a strong feeling of identity and strong emphasis on education in Tibetan. Mm. And they've all these people have graduated from Tibetan medium language schools up to college. Mm. They have built a good literacy in Tibetan. Those in Lhasa, you know, the situation in the Tibet Autonomous Region is kind of very sad for education purpose because... Okay, you go to primary school, it can be Chinese or Tibetan medium. Mm-hmm. It's still quite Tibetan. In town, it could be Chinese, but okay. But now they send schoolmasters from China saying that they don't have enough Tibetan teachers. So the school teachers from China can't speak a word of Tibetan and they won't learn because they're Chinese, so why would they learn? So they do the class in Chinese. So now you have more and more primary classes in Chinese. So we'll see the results maybe in 20 years' time. See, it's a new phenomenon. Mm. Okay, but now, after the end of primary school, you go to, what do you call it? College? No, it's not college. High school?
High school.
And then there is no Tibetan medium high school within the whole of the Tibet Autonomous Region. It's all Chinese. And the best students don't stay in the Tibet Autonomous Region. They are sent to dislocated schools, Tibetan schools in China. So you have a small, kind of a pocket, Tibetan pocket in Shanghai, in Beijing, of course, and in all provinces of China, you have at least one Tibetan class, and if there's a strong cluster of Tibetans, not local Tibetans, but sent from young Tibetans sent from Tibet Autonomous Region, you have a school of Tibetans. Their tuition is in Chinese. They have Tibetan language class for 4 hours a week to 6 hours a week. But the curriculum is hardly Tibetan. So what they do is a little bit of grammar, a little bit of literature, but their knowledge of Tibetan culture, history is appallingly low. And they are elite, because they were picked from the Tibetan Torrance region to go to these dislocated schools. And the interesting phenomenon is that instead of cynicizing them, they become, in a way, they are cynicized, because their language of expression is Chinese, and their references is Chinese. They have only one Tibetan teacher who teaches them, whatever, literature for 4 hours a week. The rest is in Chinese. But when they come back to Tibet, they have this cultural shock. They can't talk to their grandparents anymore. They have trouble communicating with their parents, with the old people. And also, when they were in this dislocated school, there was a label like Tibetan dislocated school, Tibetan school child, you know. And
like
they had
the residential schools.
Yeah.
For Aboriginal people.
Yeah.
Can I suggest that you help yourself when you're chatting? You're never going to get to eat before you leave on your taxi sojourn across.
Okay.
You sure?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm fine.
Anyway,
please.
Yeah.
So they build an awareness of being Tibetan, you know, more strong, maybe contrary to what was expected. Mm-hmm. Their feeling of being Tibetan is strengthened by their being outside and always castigated or ostracized as being, you're the young Tibetan in a Tibetan school. Mm. And their curriculum is in Chinese, they feel comfortable in Chinese, but they're always pointed at as being Tibetans. So they have this kind of flawed Tibetan identity, and they come back to Tibet, they feel they don't know much about Tibet, but they know they are Tibetans. People have been telling them that all the time. Mm-hmm. So it gives two kind of results. I know one in France, she's very nice. Her grandfather was a minister in the Tibetan government, pre-Chinese Tibetan government, so it's like top aristocratic family. She can't look up for words in a Tibetan dictionary. She was sent to school in Shanghai. She speaks fluently because her grandmother speaks, you know, to her. But her knowledge of Tibetan is appalling, to the point that I keep telling her, you should read, you know. She doesn't know anything. She doesn't know anything. And I said, I can't blame you. I know, blah, blah, blah. And it's very sad because she's elite kind of a person. And the other, but she doesn't have a very strong political awareness. Whereas another section of these young Tibetans, they come back and they're really strongly Tibetans inside and said, you know, we've been flawed. We don't know anything about our history, literature. We were in China 12 years in our lifetime, half our lifetime, and what do we know? And they try to make up, and sometimes they become more aggressively Tibetans. Some people say that in 2008, some of the protesters were among these young people.
Can I ask, I mean, I don't know that much about China, but why don't they ban the language? Because I'm used to dealing with countries where, like Taiwan, when the Kuomintang came to Taiwan, the first thing they did was ban Taiwanese, and that you just simply couldn't speak it. It was illegal to speak Taiwanese. Not only was the curriculum changed, but children weren't allowed to speak it in the schoolyards. Nevertheless, the language still thrived. In fact, maybe it was the opposite. It banned, so it became more attractive for youth. But also in the case of like Indonesia, they would ban certain languages, like actually they banned Chinese for a long time. So I'm just wondering because by allowing the language and allowing some education, I mean, it would feed this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
indeed.
I'm just curious
indeed
why they haven't taken that extra step, because they're so repressive in every other measure.
Well, during the Cultural Revolution, Tibetan was banned in many places. I'm not sure you were not allowed to speak Tibetan, but if you went to school, you were brought up in Chinese.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it happened at some point.
Right.
I think the Chinese still believe in their dream of Tibetans becoming obedient, naturally understanding the benefits they get from the Chinese state.
They just don't see them as enough of a threat, perhaps, or the language itself is enough.
But China...
to present a nice picture.
Multinational.
It's
right.
Part of the...
It's officially a multinational country,
right? Right,
yeah.
So they have to adhere to that discourse.
And I think they couldn't do that now. They
couldn't. I'm just wondering
in the
why
60s.
They... Yeah.
No, but because they really sincerely thought it was possible that you could be Tibetan, learn Tibetan, read Tibetan, and feel Chinese. They really thought it could happen. This is, I mean, I wasn't there in the 50s, but from what I read, for them, there seemed to have been no contradiction.
Oh, it's just, yeah, okay.
You were, when you said they
the Chinese government? Yeah.
Well, the masses were not, you know, they don't think about it. They don't mind anyway.
Because that to me is just so interesting.
Well, if you think, I mean, China has always been, to some extent, a multilingual country because of the huge difference in the dialects, and also Manchu, you know, which was the language of the conquerors of the Qing Dynasty, was retained. I mean, was given some kind of legitimacy. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that China is as unilingual as other countries. As long as you accept Chinese culture.
Reference point is Taiwan, right? When the KMT went there and they banned Taiwanese, and my cousins grew up getting, you know, spanked by teachers for even speaking to their classmates in Taiwanese in the schoolyard, right? It was that, they just didn't want to hear a word of it. But it was seen as much more of a threat, right? And perhaps it's the dislocation of the regime on the island or whatever, but it was also very effective, you know, in terms of trying to suppress that kind of literary. I mean, it was a two-pronged strategy, right? It was to ban the language, but also then to really not have the kind of artistic and cultural life flourish in that language as well, and have all the Taiwanese. I mean, Taiwanese became a language of business, right, which was part of the whole development project. So, you know, it was effective to a limited extent. So I was just curious because...
Yeah, I'm the same as you. I was, I think they should do that, you know, they really want to.
If from that perspective,
yeah. From that perspective,
it's almost surprising they have it. But I guess if you... As you mentioned, if there's that degree of arrogance, you would think, well...
I'm afraid that...
Yeah, you're just going to follow it.
And self-confidence and arrogance, not only... Because arrogance could lead to suppressing the language, you know, we are...
Yes, right, that's true.
But also, like a naive... For me, it's kind of very naive that they think they can come and say, we liberate you, and they will be happy to be liberated.
Right.
They really believe in their rhetoric.
Right, so it's that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then talking about this mass culture, too, there's masses who are not aware of the multiculturalism or... Tibetan situation and so forth. What I see in the internet, the cyberspace, is that this new wave of Chinese nationalism, I don't know how serious that is, but...
I think it is quite serious.
So now we have this, that kind of threatens neighboring countries, I think. Korea and Taiwan.
Everybody else.
Yeah, but on the other hand, we have a very different situation with regarding the internet culture, also talking about how internet becomes so useful for them to let people know about what's happening in Tibet. So how this kind of a dynamic kind of works out?
Well, Usher is a very special case, as far as I know. I think maybe I thought of doing five categories, because she has a category by herself. She's the unique case of a Tibetan who can tell... on the public media, not official, but on the internet, she can tell things without, for some reason, nobody knows why, without being arrested.
But isn't she in exile now?
Well, she's in Beijing, you know. She calls it an exile, but she's in China. No, that's the thing.
Okay.
It looks like she's in exile and writing from outside, but she's inside.
Okay.
She was kicked out of her job, everything.
So internal exile.
Internal exile. Well, someone used it for the Uyghur writers who are in Beijing.
Yeah.
Internal exile.
Yeah.
They have more freedom in Beijing than in Uyghur, in Xinjiang anyway. But this is a very unique case. I'm not sure we can draw conclusions from her case that, yes, there's more freedom. Or at least, but she keeps telling Tibetans through her website, push the limits. I'm pushing. I'm the living proof that we can push the limits. I'm not arrested. Okay, she's being watched, but she's not arrested. Why don't you do the same? And maybe the pre-conclusion and conclusion is that they are pushing the limits, you know. Mm-hmm. And there was... how do I go back to the... Da-da-da?
I don't know. I wonder if you go page back. The page up, page back.
No, I want to take to get rid of this and show you something else.
Oh, escape, which
what is...
What do we hear?
This. A raging storm, the crackdown on Tibetan writers and artists after Tibetan spring 2008 protests. This was published last year.
Okay.
We suddenly, I say we because I was part of this, it's a secret. We realized that there was a crackdown on artists for the first time. Mm-hmm. So why is there a crackdown on artists? Because maybe the state starts to realize that artists can be problematic, and also because the other way around, artists are becoming problematic. They used to self-censor themselves so much then that they wouldn't reach the limit, but they have reached the limit. So we put up a list of about, I mean, we realized it was not just isolated phenomena. It was too many in too short a time to be anecdotic. So there's this introduction, and then so you have this torture without trace and some list of Tibetans. So you have here, as much as possible, you have the pictures. And if you read why they were arrested, it's just, okay, he wrote a poem.
Yeah,
okay,
he wrote a poem.
Okay, Duglo. And they are young. You look, they're all young. They all come from 15 years of jail for his website, for having talked about the 2008 protest on his website. Nobody has heard. You know, he hasn't been outside. I think an Iranian person who knows Westerners will be supported by the Amnesty International, etc. He will have relays, you know, mm-hmm. among Westerners. Kuncho Tsepel, nobody knows him, nobody's met him. He's in jail for 15 years, and nobody talks about him. Kunga Tseyong, who are the real separatists? It was in the... Okay, he is 5 years in jail. This is Chokdung, he was released. Kirtikyap, still in jail. Status unknown, you know, some of them have just disappeared. Kong Kuncho, we have no pictures, we have no picture. Some of them, we have no pictures. Tantu Guanchen for his film.
Right.
He made a film pre-Olympic. He went to Tibet and made a film. It was like a investigation. What do you think of the Olympics? To the Tibetans. Most Tibetans don't care. No, but I mean, some of them said, so much money spent in Beijing. We're so poor. Why? You know, it was nothing. There was hardly anything about freedom, the Dalai Lama, freedom, independence. No. But anyway, 6 years in jail. You should see the film. I mean, it's interesting, but not that threatening, I think. Jimmy gets so, so it goes on and on and on and on.
Well, it's interesting, the switch from the focus on clerics as the nuns and monks as the threat to the state, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now
more
the artists
and more
than,
yes.
And, yeah, and,
yes.
Because
it's, I think we can think of a public sphere. I think the beginning of possibly the building up of a public Tibetan sphere within China, which is, you know, through technology, art, catering to the masses. You know, Tibetans love songs, and elite likes to read books. And for all scopes, and everyone in the Tibetan society can receive the message. Whereas it used to be confined to, you know, monasteries and nuns going and protesting and being, you know, arrested after 3 minutes and nobody would hear about them. Here it's more subtle, it just dips into, you know, DVDs are being distributed, people just talk about it, like when I was, have you read the book, and hop, I give you the book and everything. And so now the, the lay educated, the lay community is, there's no room for politics when you're Tibetan, but this is where politics, I think, occur.
Mm-hmm.
This is why I think it's very important to follow the, well, this is Ursa, you know, she's not banned, but she's...
Can I ask you another question about the form of storytelling? Okay.
Yeah, there's a monk here, but this monk was arrested for having written, he wrote things, he didn't protest, he wrote things, you know, on suspicion that his writing was reactionary. So he just wrote books, you know, he didn't go and protest. And Toshi Tunduk, that's a singer, he's completely, he can't read and write, he was just, anyway, they're all...
Do you see any pattern in the choices that Tibetans make when they wish to express ideas? I mean, why do they choose sometimes essay form or their blog? Why do they sometimes write poetry? Why do they sometimes write novels? Is there a strategy behind their choice of form? Or
I think if
what,
they
what do you feel about all of
Well, I'm not sure about the strategy, but the impact.
Okay.
singers have become quite at the forefront, and there have been many songs about importance of Tibetans to be, you know, the unity of Tibetans, mm-hmm. keeping the language, and this is a way to reach the masses. Mm-hmm. And if you want to have a message come across, you make it go through a singer, or you team with mm-hmm. a singer. Okay. And if the music's good, and if the lyrics are powerful, mm-hmm. it will be a hit. To the point that it was forbidden to listen to Tibetan tapes about 1.5 years ago in your car, because they were afraid that it might be reactionary songs. So, you know, I mean, you could be arrested driving on the road in Tibet Autonomous Region, and they could take the tapes and check what you're listening to. Mm. And they would throw them away, whatever it is anyway, you're not allowed to listen to this music, to music. So that the strategy would be, if you want to touch the huge number of people, do songs, write poems that can be put songs on team, you know, with a song singer and a poet. If you write a novel, you know you will touch only a very small portion of the society.
Okay,
few people read novels. Yes?
Well, this actually connects to your question. Reading through this, I was very conscious of the kind of rhetoric mm-hmm. that's used in the prose pieces, right, as opposed to the fiction. It's a little more abstract, there's more irony and whatever, and I was curious about that sort of reception, the repetition of mm-hmm. the Chinese propaganda terms, right? The blows, breakage, looting, and arson, that kind of repetition mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. that's parodied, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And I wondered about that kind of the reception for that,
yes.
this sort of consistent use of
because it's constantly used in the Chinese propaganda, these, you know, arsoning, looting, burning, and pilfering, or whatever it is. It ad nauseum repeated on TV about the March 14th incident, so it became like a catchphrase. So the Tibetans talked back, you know, back to the center, saying, okay, let's look at these four terms you're using. You know, you're using them all the time. I'm going to tell you what my analysis of these four terms are. And they're contesting this use of four terms. But yeah, it's what's interesting in that case is that more and more they incorporate the Chinese rhetoric, official speech, like harmony. It has become like a big joke, you know. Mm-hmm. People talk about, like, there are like laughters in the background. We say, yeah, harmony, haha. And so it's very ironic and always replying to the rhetoric and asking the Chinese authorities to be consistent. If you want harmony, we want it as well. But then what do you think of this and that? And is this an harmonious behavior for Tibetans when, for instance, when you're on a plane and you're Tibetan, you go on an internal flight, mm-hmm. a Tibetan will be searched, but not a Han Chinese. If you go to a hotel, some hotels will not take you because you're Tibetan after the 2008 events. It's not in the law, it's illegal. You can't tell someone he's not allowed just because he's a Tibetan, but they will do it. So let's talk about harmony. Yes, please. You know. So they incorporate this official speech and show the limits and the cracks and how flawed it is from the beginning. And this is, I think it's a new attitude because they're becoming more and more aware of the Chinese speech, discourse. Mm-hmm. And they're now in a position to reply. Whereas they used to ignore it, or I think now they just take it word by word. You want to talk about that? Let's talk about that.
Yeah. But at the same time, there's this parallel between that kind of ironic, parody, and the abject, the anguish that's repeated through questions. You know, mm-hmm. do we not have human rights over our own bodies? Mm-hmm. So that display of pain, too, mm-hmm. seems to be, you know, it is confrontational mm-hmm. and vulnerable yes. at the same time. But I can see how it would be very evocative in terms of garnering Tibetan support. Mm-hmm. Right? The display of pain. I'm curious about that, mm-hmm. you know, relating to the Tamil protests mm-hmm. that happened here too, where the repeated refrain was Canada help us. And it sounds so abject. It's like this display of the open wound. What were we talking about? just yesterday. Mm-hmm. But you know that how that gains support, but at the same time it's so vulnerable, so painful to even see.
It's just that it hasn't been expressed for so many years for Tibetans. To me, it's not. It might show. You know, it might be show you're vulnerable, or, but it's. We haven't reached that stage yet in Tibet. I think it's new to talk about this. So people have a strong enticement towards this kind of discourse because for the first time they see it publicly. They see publicly what they've been bottling up for so long, and this sharing of experiences is strengthening for them and gives them confidence to write more and more about it. Maybe we will reach a stage when it's not efficient anymore on the, you know, for the mass adhesion or support to this kind of opening up and telling the miseries and everything. But so far, it's quite powerful. There was a Tibetan, he's somewhere in this list, Chamdo Rinsang. He did some kind of testimonial work. He went to see old people who had experienced the 1958 uprising and who had survived. And he went to interview them and said, okay, you're old, you're 70, 80, which is old for Tibetans. You're going to die. We will forget. Please tell us about your memory of that time. And he has transcribed the conversations. And it's in spoken Tibetan, Amdo dialect. Is almost no rewriting, and he keeps everything like, no, I don't want to talk about that. It's still too painful 50 years later. And then, no, please, we beg you, you know, it's important for us. I mean, they're talking about history now. This is also a new phenomenon, it's painful years 50 years back. And we have about 20 testimonies. It's awful. If you read it, it's really... I mean, I was almost crying on the metro when I was reading that. It's terrible. It's really terrible. And what is even more terrible is that Chamdo Rinsang was arrested for having published these... It's amazing these two books were published, actually. Of course, you know, underground, everything. But it was on display because, once again, nobody denounced them. Because among the Tibetan who can read Tibetan that well, very few go to the police and say, hey, this is a bad element, you know? So, like... quiet silence about the book until someone realized it was not, you know, the content was not quite proper. So he was arrested, tortured, and he has become a bit insane after being tortured for some months in jail. And we're trying to translate it into English. We have put up a team of people to translate it into English with his, he's not always insane. I mean, he's physically also very damaged. He can't walk anymore, and he's young. I mean, he's 30 or 35. But we, through relays, we've had his authorization to translate into English, and we hope to put it in the internet. Because what's the use of that if nobody can read it? Mm-hmm. You know, these books are banned, and I think people should read it. Yeah.
We'll have to make it quick because we've run out of time. I'm so sorry, but Andy, please ask your question. Yeah.
I had a question about the use of metaphor and opacity in poems and in the poem that we read here, and it's very powerful, and also your comments, which I find very interesting about the unwillingness as of now for there to be a group of people within the Chinese government who are linguists and efficient linguists and veterans, so as to be, you know, to be able to read these texts and vet and police and exclude and arrest and torture. If I've heard you correctly, that is still, there's the very interesting sort of divide there, and that's one of the ways in which certain documents can slide in through those fissures, through that sort of arrogance there. I wonder if it's a two-pronged question. On the one hand, I wonder if there will come a time when the government decides to follow that route of becoming more adept at the Tibetan language, so as to better evaluate all of this, in quotes, of course, these texts. When I suppose that can only happen if they sense that the stakes are high enough for them to mm-hmm. make that kind mm-hmm. of quote-unquote investment. I wonder if that might happen. I mean, that's more of a speculation, because I was thinking about metaphors, these very oblique references to, say, the unwanted guest, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I wonder what would happen if even these oblique, if there's a bank of these oblique references that starts getting stored so that they become warning signifiers as much as the Dalai Lama, or as much as Tibet, mm-hmm. or Free Tibet.
Free Tibet.
Mm-hmm. But you know, because it's a very fascinating thing, because if there is a sort of reading tradition that is developing around not reading directly, but reading directly through an indirect reference, then it's very malleable. It becomes a very plastic form, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. so that you can bring in different, you can constantly change the signifiers,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Without having, expecting that your reading audience will be able to make that leap, because that sort of tradition has already emerged. So it's an interesting sort of thing I was thinking about, where you see the place of, what will become of these metaphors, these oblique references in the future. I mean, is there going to be a time when this sort of linguistic investment takes place? I was also thinking about the railway that's being built if I'm not mistaken, they're building this mm-hmm. massive rail.
Yeah.
So the rail is, again, what does that open up or close down or bring people in? Communication, all of that sort of comes in here. And I thought your point about the unwillingness to invest in Tibetan language on the part, invest, I'm using it ironically, of course, is very, very interesting, because it seems to me that the anxieties would be far more than it seems. I mean, if they think, they can never really do anything, so it seems very interesting that. But I was thinking about metaphor as a sort of tradition that is growing mm-hmm. around oblique readings.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a very direct question. I apologize.
That's okay. Do you want to respond briefly before we
maybe.
Wrap up?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, okay.
There has always been this, I call it the cat and mouse strategy, right? You can't, it's like cheating in sports, like in France and Europe, you have this bicycle and we know they always take things to go higher and quicker and whatever. But the research team who tries to stop is always one step behind, And so they invent new drugs and they stop the prison. So it's a bit like this. So even though they were able to always pinpoint, say, we know what you mean, it's so malleable, as you say, plastic, that it's quite kind of impossible. The second thing is, as you see, Tibet is huge, very sparsely populated, 2 inhabitants per square kilometer, and divided between 5 big administrative entities, themselves subdivided into mm-hmm. more than 95 or something. So you also have to take into account the local willingness, local authorities' position. Are they harsh on that? Like Tsering Tundrup, the writer who the Red Wind holds about 1958, massive uprising and etc. He was protected by the local chief, who is himself an amateur of literature.
Mm-hmm.
He is in charge of the prefecture, but he loves literature. He has translated the La Dame aux Camélias into Tibetan from Chinese in the early 1980s. So he admires Tsering Tundrup, and he did what he could for him not to go into bigger trouble and just being kicked out of his job. So that this is, So you have resistance within the system,
right.
You have difference. It's not always Beijing controlling this,
right.
It's not possible. Beijing controls economy, Beijing cannot control these micro things.
Right.
Sometimes you have, a song can be banned because it has reached the stage where the whole of Tibet knows that this song is a homage to the Dalai Lama. You can't hide it anymore. People sing it all the time and it has been clear. But other than that, because of the hugeness and the disparity,
Right.
I think it's still impossible, even though they, even if they devised a team of hyper-specialized Tibetan speakers.
Right.
I think so.
Françoise, please let us thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was amazing.
Yeah.
We've learned so much, and I have a sense it's the beginning of a conversation that I hope we can continue in various ways.
Two pieces, so
yes,
I'm sorry,
and
it's not very constructed. But
no,
I hope,
absolutely.
And I really, I'm so amazed at how responsive and knowledgeable you are all about Tibet, like the railway here, and you know, people know about Tibet so much. So I really appreciate that you prepared. That's what I say to my students, usually. I was not expecting such a. I mean, I don't know what I was expecting, but I'm so happy that you are so. Au courant, you know, like
up to date
about that. So I really appreciate, and thank you for your questions.
Yeah,
I wish I would have more time to. I think I monopolized the conversation a bit too much.
We wanted to learn from you, so
no,
it's perfect. Right. Thank you again.
Thanks.
We hope
pleasure.
That you will grab some food to eat on the way if you wish, and the other people too, if you wish to take some food or sit here for a bit and eat. I'm going to have to take.